When you need expert help and advice on issues affecting your business, NFU Cymru, we're here for you.
Farmers Guardian is proud to work alongside the Rock and Roll Farming Podcast. For all the latest news and features from across the ag industry, head to fginsight.com. You'll also find a wide variety of advice pieces to help you and your farming business flourish.
Want to get to know the people who produce the food that you eat? This is the place. Step this way and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming. Hey everybody, and welcome to Rock and Roll Farming episode 129. I'm your host, Will Evans, and today I've actually taken the show on the road down to Worcestershire in the very heart of England to talk to farmer Rob Howard. Rob, how are you?
Yeah, good, thanks Will, nice to see you.
You too. And we've got a live audience because BBC Farming Today are with us and Silver Roscoe's here.
Yes, I don't want to really interrupt the programme, so can I just say that's it from us this morning. Next week we're in Herefordshire, checking out the stats from this year's harvest, hashtag harvest19. I'm at Sybil Roscoe and the producer is Heather Simons at BBC Farming Today. And Will, you can now carry on with your podcast.
Thank you, Sybil. We're sitting in your kitchen around a rather splendid kitchen table. Why don't you tell us about that?
Yeah, it's a lovely old table. These are elm boards that were on the farm and it was built by a couple of prisoners of war in the Second World War, who stayed in Droitwich and came out every day to work on the farm. So it's sort of a lot of sentimental value on this thing.
Definitely. And your family have been on the farm for quite a long time now, haven't they?
That's right, yeah. So it's 100 years this year since great-grandfather came from Llangors in Wales.
Wow, okay. So you got some Welsh ancestry.
Absolutely. Well, it's all Welsh, yeah.
Never liked it. Okay. So are you having a centenary party?
It was one of those things that we said we'd get to, but I don't think it's going to happen.
yeah, I can imagine. Yeah. So tell us a bit about the farm.
We're a 50 acres owned farm here that we own on the family farm, and then we rent another 180 off the National Trust, and we also rent another 190 off a local landlord as well, and a couple of I think it's 35 acres of meadowland we just get for the hay.
Okay, and it's a family business?
Family business, so partnerships, my father and myself, and I've been sort of running it, you know, mainly on my own since about 2012.
Okay, so you were obviously born on the farm then, growing up, typical farm childhood?
Yeah, it was, absolutely, yeah. We've got, I mean, all our cousins and aunts and uncles sort of farm within a 2 or 3 mile radius of here. So, yeah, farm childhoods on everyone else's farm and this one, and running round, running free, you know, it was a good time.
Yeah, free range children. Yeah, so what was going on the farm back then?
So growing up, it was a mixed farm. So we had a couple of fields of grain for straw and animal feed and that sort of thing. And we ran about 30 to 40 suckler cows, and then about 650 ewes at the peak when it was, dad was running that. Yeah.
So Hereford cattle back then, right?
That's right, yeah. So Dad and Grandad had pedigree Herefords, and they used to go all around showing, and they never missed the Royal Welsh. But over time, was when we were young, you know, Dad with young kids, he decided to give that up and just focus on commercial cattle. And then that's it.
Okay, and they sent a bull to China once, didn't they?
That's right, yeah. So, yeah, they exported a bull to China, they exported a couple of bulls, yeah, and I remember Dad spent ages washing the bull 3 times a day to get a bit of hair growth on it to present it perfectly for them. And then when it arrived, they thought this teddy bear looked wrong. They weren't sure it should have the long hair on. So.
Yeah, that's really cool. So beef farm, 1990s, of course, the time when BSC emerged in the UK. We must be about the same age. What are your memories of BSC? Did it hit the business quite hard?
Yeah, I remember our neighbour, Bunk Richards, came over the week before, and he'd sold all his fat cattle and the trade was flying. It was one of those times, it's really high trade. We were just about to sell ours the following week, so he was coming over to sell to celebrate and to say, you know, you better get yours in next week. And then I remember it was on, if it was a market on the Wednesday, I think it might have been the Friday that they announced the BSE outbreak. And obviously what that did to prices, and then we decided to hold on to them for a bit longer. And yeah, I remember that not being an easy time. Like, we didn't have BSE or anything, but yeah, that, you know, that had an impact on the business. You know,
yeah, it definitely did for us. I remember sort of being very conscious of how stressed and worried my mum and dad were. You know, you could almost see them aging with the stress and worry at the time. It was really difficult, wasn't it?
No, exactly. And I think that's it, isn't it? You sort of grow up with those perhaps negative conversations around the farm table, and you can see that stress. And yeah, I think that, you know, has an impact on whether kids want to carry on and all that sort of stuff, doesn't
it? Definitely. Did you grow up wanting to be a farmer, though? I
kind of did. I mean, mum and dad actually were really keen to push me away from farming. They really wanted me to do anything but farming. And that probably ensured that was all I wanted to do.
So. Okay. But you did a bit of travelling around the world?
Yeah, we went, I travelled with a mate round to South Africa, New Zealand, Australia for 6-7 months.
Wow.
Before going to uni. You know, there wasn't a job on the farm. There wasn't enough income on the farm to include, you know, to bring someone else in. So yeah, I went out and got a job somewhere else after uni.
Okay. So what happened with the Barmy Army in New Zealand?
Oh, yeah. Well, we landed in New Zealand, and it wasn't on purpose, but we accidentally jumped on a bus that was touring around New Zealand that was filled with the Barmy Army.
Yeah, for England cricket supporters, ultras, for people who aren't from the UK.
Absolutely, yeah. So, yeah, so it was a fabulous time. I don't remember a huge amount of it. We didn't have any tickets for any of the games, but we just followed them around from city to city and did all the usual things. It was really good. One of the guys in the Barmy Army was absolute dead ringer for Mike Atherton as well.
Okay.
And I remember we did a very early morning bungee jump with a load of the Barmy Army lads, and we were ribbing the Kiwis because they'd lost a test match. And this guy, who we called Mike because he looked like Mike Atherton, was going off. Just as he went off the bungee jump, the Kiwi guys who were sort of strapping him and everything, they were like, no, it's not tied on, just as he was, as he was going. Got their own back.
Jeez, okay. Yeah. Wow. So you studied land management at Reading Uni. No doubt you were a conscientious and diligent student while you were there.
I'd like to say so. Mum and dad aren't listening, but not really. I was pretty much more interested in rugby and drinking, really. And it didn't, you know, I think I said to you before, pretty useless. It was a good time. I don't think I really ever wanted to be a land agent, which is what the course was designed for.
Mm-hmm.
But I got out of there with a degree, and you know, that's all that matters.
You didn't fancy wearing the red corduroy trousers, is that what it was?
Well, you know, it's always tempting, isn't it? The red socks.
Yeah. So, but there was some turbulence going on at home around then, right?
That's right. Yeah. So while I was away at college, it was. Foot and mouth had kicked off, and the same thing with BSE, I guess, really. We didn't have the disease, and we'd have been a lot better off if we had. But price moves at that time, mm-hmm. and we'd just increased the sheep numbers and everything, and it, you know, to farm a way out of a, you know, out of trouble, I guess. And it just all moved at the same time, and at the same time, Dad was ill, had major spinal surgery at that time, and so we ended up selling 130 acres, going down to 50 acres while I was away at college. And I think actually it's interesting because that was kind of a wake-up call of really, you know, I'd lived, you know, an easy life and had, you know, everything you needed, mm-hmm. and very lucky to grow up on a farm. And you realise actually when you lose it how special it is.
Mm-hmm.
And probably that's what ended up really focusing me back onto the farm and what I wanted to do. Trying to make the most of that.
Okay. So tell us about some of the jobs you did after graduating.
First job, I tried to avoid being a land agent. I I went to work for ADAS as a farm conservation advisor. I was only there for 7 or 8 months, but I'd always been interested in wildlife and growing up with granddad showing me all the different plants and things like that. And so that was kind of a natural thing I could go into, and enjoyed that work. And then moved on to working for Herefordshire Nature Trust, working on grassland project in a specific area. And that was great. I loved meeting the people in the local villages, in the rural communities. And I remember we had to work to get some of these old pastures fenced so we could graze them, because they got really, you know, high interest in terms of orchids and wildflowers mm-hmm. and things. And I remember there's this old lady, there's parts of Herefordshire sort of tucked away. They didn't have electricity or water to the cottage. And this isn't okay. that long ago. This yeah. was sort of, you know, early 2000s. And this old lady, who's, I think, I probably shouldn't say this, but she's nicknamed Dirty Lil. And because you go, because there's no running water in the house, obviously. But there was a phone box outside the house where she was, a red phone box, and that was immaculate. And that was, she polished it every day, and the glass and everything. And I remember we were trying to do some community consultation, get people to come along and get involved. And she wanted to know what we were going to do. We were going to fence these pastures and try and return grazing. And she hated it. She absolutely hated it. And, you know, she'd have blazing row with me and tell me all this stuff. And I remember we had our first local event with all the local farmers coming and the community coming. And I could see her in the thing. And after the event, she's come sort of striding up to me. And I wonder what she's going to say in front of all these people. And she says to me, "Do you know that Rob Averitt, do you? He's the devil, he is." And so I kind of had a decision to make what I did in that moment. So I just agreed with her. And then from that moment on, every time I saw her outside on, you know, in the area, she'd just give me evils. And then every time I saw her at an event or anything, she'd come and tell me how terrible Rob Haver was. So, yeah, it was some characters anyway.
Do you think she put a curse on you at all?
Maybe, yeah. I could see her muttering something under her breath.
Jeez, okay.
We're going to take a short ad break now to talk about agricultural weighing specialist Griffith Elder. Griffith Elder specialise in agriculture with their weighing equipment. They design, manufacture here in the UK and supply weighbridges, portable weighbeams, multi-axle weighbridges and a host of other weighing equipment for weighing on the farm. The scales are a great way to know how much you've taken from the field and keep track what you have coming in and going out. The portable weighbeams are incredibly easy to install, so no need for any groundworks, and can be placed straight in the yard or moved from store to store as and when you need. All of their scales come with an extensive range of recording equipment options and farm management software, and one very popular piece of kit is their cab fob system, which enables the driver to record the weight of their load without having to leave the comfort of the cab. Built to last for decades, Griffith Elder pride themselves in making simple to install, easy to operate and proven longevity weighing equipment for all their products.
So you went on to work in the Malvern Hills managing an upland nature reserve afterwards.
Yeah, I really enjoyed that. 3,000 acre estate. It's charity owned, but as kind of a nature reserve. But working with commoners to get grazing back on the hills, which had been lost. It was kind of... In its time, I suppose, it was almost by accident a kind of a rewilding experiment where actually grazing in the 70s and 80s had disappeared, and then there'd been this influx of wildlife on all the scrub coming through, but then after about 45 years and it all went to secondary woodland, all the wildlife disappeared mm-hmm. and realised there was a lot of work to do scrub clearing and an endless job scrub clearing to keep that succession of stage that the wildlife liked. So I think that was an interesting grounding, really, but also working with the commoners, open land. We were actually started back then, and this is going back to 2007, we were doing electric fenced enclosures. You know, these are steep hills, sort of 45, 50 degree slopes, you know, 3-4 strands of electric we're putting around those and helping the commoners. And so, yeah, really interesting, and to see the wildlife change and managing that. Yeah.
For the benefit of people not from the UK, what are commoners?
Yeah, commoners. So those are people where the charity was what's called the soil owner. So they own the land and the mineral rights on this say 3,000 acres. And then there are people who have property rights attached to their houses, which they can lease to other people or use themselves to graze livestock. And that's a property right, just like owning property. They have the right to turn livestock out, a certain number of sheep, which is called a stint. And they have a certain number of stints they can graze on common at any one time. It's a long-held right that predates Parliament, so it's not something that Parliament can revoke either. It's a really interesting sort of old English system.
Definitely, yeah. Okay, so you got married while you were there. How did you meet your wife?
Yeah, we got married while I was there, but I met Claire when I was at Herefordshire Nature Trust. About every 6 months, a friend of mine, Phil Burton, ran a course or an internship program for people wanting to become ecologists who'd just done a degree in ecology or zoology. And so every 6 months, he'd get 7 or 8 interns come through the system. And being environmental, most of them were female. And being a young man there, you know, it was, I suppose, like Top Gun would say, it's a target-rich environment. But the second tranche, though, actually, was Claire was in, and okay. Met Claire, and that was it. Never looked back, really.
Yeah, okay. And three kids now,
yeah, that's it.
Are they helping out on the farm much?
Yeah, they do. Yeah, I mean, sometimes willingly. And they enjoy it, and I think they do sort of cherish where they live. They're grateful for, you know, what they've got here, and it's really nice. Actually, one of the things... with the events we put on, we get them to count the wildflowers and the orchids to do the monitoring for us, and actually to have positive stories about things improving rather than like those BSE and foot and mouth stories we had when we were kids. Yeah, I think that's a hopeful thing. I hope one of them will be interested, whoever it is, or all of them, you know, we'll find a way.
Yeah, cool. If all of them are interested, that'll put some pressure on you, won't it?
Yeah, well, I'll just have to, they'll have to keep looking for tenant farms, I think.
So while you were doing these other jobs, you had actually joined the family business in 2003. Were you trying to make changes as early as back then?
Yeah, I think so. Perhaps not so much at home, you know, that with dad involved and that father-son dynamic everyone's probably familiar with. But I did, with the wildlife and conservation background, I was doing conservation grazing for the Wildlife Trust and National Trust and other people. And taking on short-term tenancies with local landowners, losing them, you know, and sort of a lot of back and forth, you know, building up, going back down, you know, with land tenure, it can be difficult, you know. And but, you know, spent about 10 years really finding lots of ways not to make any money. And then we sort of hit upon the holistic management stuff, and that really helped take us forward.
And you bought some sheep on an egg credit card, of all things.
Yeah, that's it. I love that. Yeah, you remember those?
Yeah.
No, it was it. I think it was 2003, and I stupidly decided to become a conservationist because you don't earn any money. But I wanted to buy some sheep and to be more involved at home. And yeah, so I think that was it. $3,500 on the egg credit card to start us off. And I think it was a bit of a shock when we unloaded the trailer and a load of Wiltshire horns got off the trailer. Dad's face was a picture.
So you left the Malvern Hills job in 2011 and went to work at the Rare Breeds Survival Trust. That must have been interesting.
Yeah, it was really interesting. It was a really good learning experience. It's a great organisation. It's full of, you know, really passionate people doing really good work. But anyone who's been involved with the Breed Society knows there's a lot of politics involved, and the Rare Breed Survival Trust has got about 180 odd breed societies that all feed into it. So it was very much a people job, and I think I was probably somebody who wanted to do things my way and maybe be less consultative. And I think there was a little bit of a clash with, you know, other approaches, shall we say. But really enjoyed it and met some wonderful people there.
So after there, you mentioned the 180 acre tenancy with the National Trust. It was then that you got the offer of that.
Yeah, that's right. It was it was a funny thing. I resigned that job without another job to go to, and so it was sort of feeling a little bit insecure. But then within about 3 weeks, I'd had a job offer from Natural England as a lead advisor for them on grassland ecology, and then I'd also been offered this tenancy by the National Trust, who had offered it to me when we were at when I was working for Rare Breeds, but I didn't have the time then, and it had just worked out, and it came up. I knew the people there, and they'd been sort of asking about advice on grazing stuff, which I'd known from the Malvern Hills from what we'd done there. So we sort of jumped in, and that was an opportunity to try something away from home, that I could have a bit more freedom than I maybe would do at home in terms of the management. Yeah.
So what did you stock it with initially?
So initially we went and bought store cattle. So I went and bought store cattle, and we ran them around 12 months. So we bought them at 12, 15 months, ran them around 12 months with no hay, just on stockpiled forage, which is grass that grows up throughout the season that you save for winter grazing, like standing hay, really. We didn't put any stock in it until the July, even though we took it on in the May to let it all build up. And yeah, we had one of the wettest winters on record that winter.
Of course.
Which was good and bad. I was a bit worried we'd made a mess, but actually it turned out fine. And I kind of knew then if I could do it in those conditions, we could do it any year in our climate. Yeah. But yeah, I remember Dad being very sceptical initially, but still being supportive. But I remember when we sold them, we hit the market just right. I think we bought them at, I think it's average £740 a head, and I think we sold them. They averaged over £1,300 anyway, and you know, the check came in from when we sold them, and Dad was, you know, put his hand on my shoulder and just said, "You better go and buy some more of them." that was, you know, high praise from him.
That is high praise from a farming dad, isn't it? So when did the change to pedigree Angus cattle come about?
That's actually what we wanted to start with, but the bank wouldn't they'd lend us on an overdraft with store cattle because we could turn them over in 12 months and they were felt more secure rather than give us a loan on cows. And we did that system for a couple of years of running the stores round and finishing them. And one year I sold all the cattle. Again, the market moved at the right time for us and we hit that well. So sold the fat cattle well, and then I just went and bought, instead of going and buying some more stores, I just went and bought some Angus cows, and then I phoned up the bank manager afterwards and said, "Now it's your problem." No, they were very good actually, and they'd seen the system was working, and so they were a bit supportive of that.
So why did you choose Angus as opposed to any other breed?
Well, we looked at all the native breeds, and we, over the years, we'd had most of them here, so we'd got experience of them. And obviously, you know, we were Hereford breeders for the long term. But in terms of having a polled animal that hit market requirements, there's obviously the premium, but also a native breed that, you know, there's quite a diverse genetic pool with Angus, but there are the genetics within that that can absolutely thrive in the 100% grass-fed system that we run. And so that was really, you know, easy to manage, easy calving, no dehorning, which was a big thing for us. We thought they got better udders than the Herefords, to be honest, and, you know, having had a look at those. But to be honest, you know, look, there's good cattle of all breeds. We're not here to say that anyone is special. But moving into the pedigree side of it was, I was already doing, because I was quite early on the mob grazing, holistic grazing front. And so we'd be running events and I was getting invited to speak at stuff, and I wasn't charging for that. And Dad kept nagging me, like, "Why are you telling them all how to do it? You know, what's doing it for you?" And then I have a think about that. And it was good advice, you know. And so actually we thought, well, with having a pedigree Angus and being able to have some stock that thrive in this system, so there's more people interested in it, then we've got a market for that. Yeah. And that provides us with a market for the cattle that, you know, hopefully allows us to stay on the farm and give the next generation opportunity if we can build that business up.
Yeah. Okay. So we've touched on the holistic planned grazing. How did you first come across that as a concept?
I was thinking back on this. It was when we were involved early with the Pasture Fed Livestock Association, and great organisation, farmer led, And that was a real help getting in there. And I remember John Meadley, the chairman at the time, had recommended Andre Vauzin's book, Grass Productivity, which I still think is the standard that, you know, for our climate, as I don't think it's been bettered in terms of grazing techniques. And Alan Savory's, the holistic management chap, has said the same thing for our climate as well. But Alan Savory had written the foreword to that book because it was a reprint. The book was written in the 50s. And I saw what he'd written, and I thought, well, I better buy his book as well. So then I bought that, went through it, read it time again, and it was kind of like a light bulb moment. And then Kurt Gadzia, who's one of the most respected trainers, holistic management trainers in the world, he happened to be organised by Regen Ag to come over and do a training session the following November. So I'd already started doing it, and this is going back 7-8 years now, I think. So I lose track, but and that really helped cement the planning process, and then helped us get in to start that, taking on the new tenancy and all that stuff. So,
okay. Yeah. So how does it work in practice? How does holistic grazing work in practice?
Well, it's interesting that everyone always wants to talk about the holistic plan grazing part, but not the holistic management part.
Uh-huh.
And I think the holistic management part is actually the important bit.
Okay.
Something that Alan Savory says is that every grazing system that's been created has failed. And that's for a number of reasons. It can be because other things affect a farming business other than the grazing system. Mm-hmm. So, you know, you're looking at the animal health, but you might also be looking at your family and, you know, the social side of things and how that affects your quality of life goals. Sure. And all that. And, you know, if the family farms ends up getting split up, then the grazing system fails, you know, if it's too much work. And so I try these days just to completely uncomplicate it. I mean, all we do really is say that the key rule for me is that as you're grazing grass, you want to not graze it again until it's regrown to its full height, so that so its roots and crown have got the energy stores back in the roots and crown. And if you regraze before then, you're going to have to feed that plant in some way. So that's your field amendment, start going in, and that's cost. So at least work with the plant physiology from the start. And the way we do that is we always have a back fence, at least on day 4 of grazing. And we usually move every 2 days. But then we'll be flexible, you know, if I'm going on holiday or whatever, you know, we'll just abandon that and we'll do something different for a week or so.
Okay.
Because those quality of life goals are more important. There's more important things than grass. And so adding that in and also focusing on the economic impact and doing a marginal reaction test on everything you're doing. So I know there are a lot of folks who are moving cattle like 8 times a day and all this sort of stuff, but in all honesty, if I honestly look at the labour input and the return on labour for that, it just isn't there.
Yeah.
And so whilst there might be marginal improvements in productivity, I just don't see that stacking up. But each to their own. I'm not saying other people are wrong.
No.
I think I was saying to you earlier, we were talking about how sometimes it's not as complicated as people make out sometimes. And I've certainly had people coming on the courses for 4 or 5 years who still haven't started yet. And I kind of see that as a bit of a failure on my part, because if it seems too big a shift at the moment, because it is a simple thing. So the key thing for me is just leave more grass. So leave at least 4 inches as your minimum area, and always move them on by 4 days. So that's 4 and 4, easy to remember. And just start. And once you start, you'll see the benefits, and you'll see it in the soil and in your productivity.
And what's been the steepest learning curve for you?
I think probably the biggest thing is managing them all on my own and going up to 90 cows, carving all those myself and then running them all through the handling system. So it's just managing and moving larger amounts of cattle.
Mm-hmm.
I think that, you know, I've always been okay at the planning side, and that, you know, I can do, and I understand the physiology and the biology stuff, but I think that's probably... using low stress cap handling and doing things like that has really helped. But it's still, you know, once you get to a scale, and I think that's one of the issues in the farming industry, is that you need to be at such scale, but you also need to be at such low labour cost to make a profit that, like, we're all on our own.
Yeah.
And, you know, if things go wrong, you know, you're on your own, aren't you? So
definitely. So presumably the aim is to keep cattle out 365 days of the year. You've talked about wet winters before. Sometimes that surely doesn't always work. What do you do then?
Well, so far, I mean, we have kept them all out every year for the last 3 years. I think if we had a really wet weather system, something we've done last year we really looked at was the bale grazing, like they do in Canada, North America. And so we set this grid of bales, round bales out in September. And then that gives us the flexibility that, you know, if we get a month of solid rain, they could just go into the, what we call the bale pod. That's what they call it in Canada. They go into the bale pod for 3 weeks and they can come out again, back onto the grazing platform when things are dried out. And because the cattle aren't on the platform when it's raining, actually it's amazing how quickly it dries out. With 3 or 4 days of dry weather, you can get back out there. And if there's like heavy snow for a month or whatever, it gives us flexibility. But we make sure we've got enough hay on the farm to do that. You know, and that's part of the system.
Yeah. Yeah. And are you seeing a lot more interest from other farmers?
Definitely. Yeah. We did an event in November, which we had 85 people come from Ireland, Scotland, Cornwall, Wales, all over, interested in seeing what we do. I mean, I'm always keen to point out we've pretty much copied everything we do. We're just copying other people, maybe adapting it to our climate, our farm. Every farm's different. But yeah, it's been good. And it's been a good way to get people to come out and see the cattle. We had another open day at the end of July, just gone. And Farmers Guardian came out and I think they're doing a piece on it. And it does seem to be gaining traction. But I think because margins are so low in suckler cow systems at the moment, that actually low cost systems is a good way of surviving. And I think that's pushing people to look for, you know, alternatives to the current thinking.
Definitely. Well, I went to the Groundswell event this year, and I know you spoke there last year. You can really see from events like that that there's huge wave of interest in these kind of farming systems, isn't there?
Yeah, absolutely. 100%. And it's, what's really pleasing is it's coming from the practitioners. Yeah. I think a lot of farming advice in the past has come from institutions and funded by the industry. And maybe that's been more geared to work for the industry than the family farm. But I think what's great about what a lot of the innovation that's going on is just family farmers. And they're getting out and doing it, sharing it on social media. Yeah. Things like Groundswell are fabulous for that, I agree. Yeah. Mm.
And this kind of thing is very timely at the moment, isn't it? With more focus on farming in an environmentally focused way. Emissions from agriculture is being talked about a lot in the press. And if we're farming in this way, then we can point to this and say, well, look, this is what we're doing, isn't it?
That's right. I think that absolutely is important. And I think that's why we've been getting a bit of interest as well, because, you know, the reality is that I think probably the vast majority of cattle farming in the UK is carbon negative, if you look at it honestly. And so I think that's a really good story for us potentially. I think we've just got to keep banging that drum and keep pushing it out. And as the market gets bigger and we start doing more with the grass-fed systems, I think that's only going to benefit us if we can show the environmental benefits of it all.
Yeah. And we had a walk around the farm earlier and it was really obvious the environmental improvements you've made. I mean, we could hear all the grasshoppers and, I mean, they were really loud, weren't they? It was really cool to hear. You've obviously been involved in environmental schemes and seen a huge improvement with that.
Yeah, I think the environment schemes offer a lot of potential for people to put their toe in the water and start, and particularly with having a more diverse sward. So, you know, we've obviously been on a diet of ryegrass and clover for a long time. And that creates its own costs and issues as well as its benefits. It's a very productive system. But I think as people start to get into more diverse systems and perhaps, you know, with the cost of reseeding and the return on investment on that, that having a permanent pasture that's got everything you want in it and that gets more productive every year because of the way you manage it, you know, that to me is quite exciting, that you feel like you're moving in the right direction. You're not always having to catch up or put field amendments on just to make the grass grow, essentially.
Definitely. So going back to the cattle then, how do you sell them?
We sell mainly to dairy farms, other Angus breeders. The open days are a great way of selling them. Sometimes it's a bit of a, I don't want to say an education job, but it's one of those things where it's, you know, we're doing something a little bit different, probably a smaller framed Angus animal than, mm-hmm. than most, than the modern Angus and some of the other beef cattle around. But I think mainly because that maternal end of the suckler cow's got to be efficient, and it's got to be able to, you know, that smaller or lower body weight, slightly smaller frame score means it's more efficient. It's got lower energy requirements, but it's probably going to wean a bigger calf as yeah. a proportion of its body weight. And so people buy the bulls to reduce their big dairy crosses they've got. So you've got a Charolais dairy cross. They'll put one of our bulls on to have a smaller replacement, and maybe on the rest of the cows, they're not keeping for replacements. They might use a continental to get a bit more performance, but breeding the females. So we're looking for, you know, although we say it's a smaller animal, we want the heifers to grade. So if the heifers make weight and they grade O plus or better, then that's kind of our parameters. So you're getting a marketable calf every year, and nothing beats a live calf. You can't improve growth rate to the event of, you know, if you get your carbon percentage up, a live calf every year is going to beat any growth rate.
Definitely. And you also do some direct sales. How did you get started with that?
In terms of the meat sales?
Yeah.
Yeah, well, it's something we've probably knocked on the head more.
Okay.
Yeah. We, you know, over the last sort of 10, 15 years, we were doing a lot of mutton at one point. I was buying old Wiltshire horns from other breeders and selling mutton direct, and that was going well and we were getting a good price for it, but the direct selling is a lot of work.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, we were delivering meat till silly o'clock at night and getting out, and it just became unsustainable, I think, long term. And I think for us, if we can sell the same margin in a live animal with the pedigree livestock, uh-huh. then that seems like a better job to me, to be honest. I also prefer the customers, or I probably should admit to that.
Well, it's interesting you said that, because it's obviously been such a big growth in direct sales and people talking about it a lot at the moment. But
yeah, I think it is interesting. I think some people are cut out for it.
Yeah.
And, you know, if you're a real extrovert and a people person and you love talking to the general public, then that's brilliant, go for it. But there's lots of farmers out there who it's just not for them. And I think we need to find a place for them rather than tell everyone they should direct sell. I mean, one of the things we're trying to do with the Pasture Fed Livestock Association is if we can form a cooperative to produce the grass-fed beef that there is a demand for, big demand for, big producers, some of the biggest names in food are coming wanting big contracts on grass-fed animals. And so actually, if you've got a reasonable size farm and you want to sell all your fat cattle through that scheme and get a premium, then if we can get that, you know, that's what needs to happen on that end, is to get the supply chain sorted. But it'd also be nice if farmers own that supply chain, which is why we want to try and keep control of it for the family farmers, so we don't lose that to too much to the processors.
So that presumably is customer driven. Customers are asking for grass fed beef, and then the supermarkets are looking for more suppliers.
Yes, I think that's the case, because they can't really at the moment claim to have truly grass-fed beef on the shelf.
No.
So I'm assuming that's where it's come. But yeah, absolutely, the biggest names in the industry are coming forward asking PFLA for that.
Okay, so it's very obvious that the environment and nature is important to you. Why do you think that is? Is it sort of sense of responsibility you feel, or is it just something that you enjoy?
I really enjoy it. I've always been interested. You know, I always used to watch the wildlife programs on TV when I was little, when that was my babysitter. and I've also been lucky to have some really good mentors in it as well in the past. So just say with my grandfather was always showing me where the orchids were, or you know, where the different species were, and he was interested, had his own names for the different plants, but still knew the different ones. But also some of the old sort of Victorian type old naturalists, some of them no longer with us, but some really eccentric guys, like a guy called Dr. Michael Harper, who was a GP who used to do like slideshows in his lounge, and he'd be cycling off on call around Herefordshire, and he'd be seeing some random lichen on a farm roof, and the farmer would find him climbing on the ridge of his farm building because he knew that there was a certain caterpillar that ate that particular lichen. And you see the passion they had, but the farmers never minded because they could see these people were interested in the animals. And I think that really gave me the interest. And I think we maybe we've lost that a bit and become a bit policy focused in conservation. I think the other side of it as well is that as farmers, we used to be the ones who knew what everything was in the countryside. And maybe our production focus over the last 50 years has meant we maybe feel a little bit disinherited from that role as a steward of the countryside. But I do feel that's really coming back now. I do feel these are our rural communities. This is our area. Mm-hmm. And we should be the ones sort of designing policy on this and taking it forward from the ground up. So,
do you think that, speaking of farming policy, obviously the dreaded B word, we're going to have our own UK farm policy soon. Do you think that will be a good thing for the environment?
I think, to be honest, I think the way we were saying about regenerative agriculture, I think what's great about that is it's a family farmers driving it.
Mm.
And I'm now seeing with Natural England and other bodies, they're following the farmers in regenerative agriculture that are leading on this. So I think actually policy is kind of in all sectors actually is kind of in chaos. It's really unpredictable as we've seen with Brexit and whatever. But whatever happens with that, I think the best thing we can do is to have low cost resilient businesses. And also, you know, people talk about low cost food, but you know, if they're not going to subsidise us to produce low cost food, then that agenda goes out the window. Yeah. And I think it's time for us to start justifying the quality of what we produce in this country, which, you know, in terms of animal welfare and in terms of the environment, whatever people say is the best in the world. And we should be shouting that from the rooftops.
Definitely. I mean, Michael Gove has referenced regenerative agriculture quite a lot, hasn't he? I know he's not in the job now, but he certainly was. And, you know, that's something I don't think that DEFRA secretaries in the past would have even looked at.
No. And I was at the Country Fire Live event the other day, and Tony Juniper, the Natural England chairman, the new chairman, was talking. And one of the audience members after the speaking session asked a question saying, oh, well, with cows causing all this climate change, shouldn't we be eating less meat or no meat?
Mm-hmm.
And so the chairman of Natural England then stood up, got really animated and said, no, we shouldn't be eating less meat. We should be eating better meat, and actually started talking about holistic grazing.
Mm-hmm.
And I couldn't believe it. I was like, I was sort of frozen in my seat. You know, the hairs on the back of my neck went up. I was like, this is starting to move.
Yeah.
And I think actually, if we embrace these systems in this country in farming, I think we can actually position ourselves in the world market as leaders in terms of that environmental quality. And if we can sell that product, and if we've got a government that's now focused on marketing British produce rather than the whole of the EU, obviously only being able to promote EU produce, mm-hmm. then maybe that extra focus on what we sell and what we stand for, which is high animal welfare, we lead the world in our environmental policy and mm-hmm. farming, and that's what we should be selling it on.
Yeah, no, I agree. Okay, so in the notes you sent me, you said you still work for Natural England. You also said, I think it's important to think about alternative income in a farming business and also access to relatively normal people. Which I really liked. Not working on your own all the time. Can you expand on that a bit?
Yeah, I suppose just from speaking to a few people on family farms, and they're struggling. You know, one of the difficulties you have in any business, never mind farming, is that if you're taking a salary out, and if your salary is equal to your profit, then you can't invest in the business to grow the business. And that's the same in any business. If you want to invest in the business, you've got to invest the profits in it.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think, well, for me, I didn't feel like just borrowing more and more was the best way to invest in the business. I think we should perhaps just have, there can sometimes be a little bit of a stigma about having a job outside,
mm-hmm.
But the reality is, if I want to invest the profits each year, which I'm doing in growing our herd, so if we spend about 25 grand a year on cattle each year to grow our operation, then that means that's 25 grand I can't pay myself. If I pay myself, I wouldn't be able to invest in the business.
Yeah.
So I think let's be a bit more honest about that. And I also think it's interesting meeting a couple of guys in Wales, actually, who are looking at getting a job in the Welsh sector, in the policy sector, whether it's in Natural England or Natural Resource Wales or all these different organisations. Well, actually, the more farming people we have within those, they're probably going to work better.
Yes.
And they'll come up with better ideas and be more practical. And so I think that side of it, and I think you touched on the other one, which is I really enjoy working for Natural England. Mm-hmm. You know, I know that it gets bad press, but actually the people on the ground, the advisors on the ground, he said, do you know what? And everyone involved really is they're just good people and they're competent and they're good. And I think sometimes just all the systems and the processes are what gunk it all up.
Yeah.
I think it's good to be able to go into an office sometimes, escape the farm. It feels like a bit of a break sometimes as well. So,
yeah. Oh, sure. Yeah. So before we start to wrap things up, what are some very basic grazing management tips for farmers, like things that we can all do?
For the first thing is really simple with electric fences is just to have a back fence. And a really simple one is to look at thinking about a 30-acre field that you might graze with cattle, say, for a month. And then if you graze that for a month, for 30 days, let's say, and you move them out of that field, then that field starts regrowing on day 31 after you've grazed it. But if you strip graze and had a back fence every day, then that field starts regrowing on day one. And therefore, by the time you come out of the field, you might even be able to go back in at the start. So even if there were no productivity benefits, which there are, then just managing your grazing is going to give you more grass through the year. And it's going to allow you to increase your stocking rate and decrease your costs. I did a day up in Scotland, a big estate, 10,000 acre estate up there, and did a day training course there. But they basically, just through grazing management, they cut their entire fertilizer bill out, carrying the same amount of stock, I think they had 320 suckler cows, and they were saving 40 grand a year on fertilizer in one go. Jeez. I mean, they changed that in 1 year of grazing. So,
okay.
You know, it's worth your time.
That's a pretty dramatic improvement, isn't it?
Wow. Yeah,
okay.
Exactly.
So I guess it's looking at profit per acre, not productivity per acre.
Absolutely. Yeah. So your costs and looking at risk as well. So if you look at the really good systems on intensive grass lays and reseeding and all that sort of stuff, they stack up and they're great systems, but there's a hell of a lot of money out the door before you get anything back. And so in terms of betting a family farm on commodity prices not coming down, I think that's a very high risk. So if there's only a marginal benefit to having those high input systems, then I wouldn't bet the farm on the government looking after you on a commodity price.
No. Okay. So what are your future plans for the farm, Rob? Where would you like to take it?
Ultimately, I want to be able to provide a business that the next generation can come into and feel secure and positive about coming into. And I think for us to do that, it's about building a customer base for a pedigree Angus that work in grass-fed systems. So our aim as a business is to be the best place to come for your forage-based bulls. And that's our aim. And the test of that will be in how the cattle perform. So if we provide cattle for people that work for them and help make them money, then we'll still be in business. And that's how I see it.
Okay. All right, then. We will wrap this up with the five traditional hard-hitting questions if you're ready for these. Okay. What is your all-time favourite song?
Well, that's a difficult one. It's got to be between Thunderstruck AC/DC and the Metallica sign. Metallica,
yeah,
Nothing Else Matters. I'm not really a metal man, but I just love those two songs. And actually, our first dance at Claire and my wedding was Metallica, Nothing Else
Was
Matters.
It? That's awesome. So, really cool. I love a bit of Metallica.
So I better choose that one, I think.
Brilliant. Okay. What was your favourite childhood TV show?
That's a difficult one. I loved all the wildlife programmes on TV, but I think I've got to be the A-Team.
Yeah.
Yeah, a bit Hannibal.
Yeah, it's just, we were so lucky with the 80s, weren't we? 80s TV shows.
It's fabulous.
There's nothing like that now. It's a sort of crap reality show. Yeah. Okay, you're on death row going to the Electric Chair tomorrow. What are you having for your last ever three-course meal?
Three-course meal. Wow, that's going to be... What I'm going to do is I'm going to have a roast beef dinner.
Yeah.
Obviously, it's Angus beef.
Classic, yeah.
And then I'm going to have a sherry trifle.
Yeah.
And then I'll have the cheese course at the end.
Brilliant. Okay. Very 80s. That's awesome. All right. What achievement are you most proud of?
I think that's
It's a big question, isn't it?
It's a big question. Yeah. And I'm not going to dodge the question, but I'm going to say that I really try hard not to think about that.
Yeah.
Think about things in that way.
Yeah.
So when I was talking about the business just then, I'm talking about what things are going to look like in the future. But I don't think there's ever a point where you reach a success or failure.
Yeah.
Because it's like, someone once said to me, it's like a film or a book. It's like it's not getting to an achievement or getting to a goal as quick as possible. Like, you don't think, oh, that was a good book because I got to the end quick, or a film. There's ups and downs, and it's about the whole ride. And I think that's how I look at that. So, to be honest, I said to Claire that I'm looking back, I was thinking, there's so much I want to achieve that I don't really feel like I've achieved any of it yet. So that's kind of how I feel.
That's very profound, Rob.
Is it? That was the first time for everything.
So, lastly, what's your favourite agriculture-related social media account to follow?
Obviously, apart from your own.
Shucks.
I really like Christine Page, Smiling Tree Farm.
Yeah.
She's brilliant, and I think she's a real leader in the sector. She's so valuable to regenerative agriculture and so knowledgeable. I like the Calf at Foot Dairy as well. They're doing some really interesting stuff. And then in terms of can I mention another podcast?
Absolutely, you can. Yeah.
So I was on Clay Connery does the Working Cows podcast.
Yeah, I listened to that.
Which is an American one.
Yeah.
And I did that with him. He's a lovely guy. And and that's really good. That's all kind of focusing on regenerative agriculture with cows.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, like many of us with cows, we'll listen to content to do with that for hours.
Yeah. All right then, Rob. Thank you very much for taking time out of your day to speak to us all, BBC Farming Today as well, and welcoming us to your home. And I absolutely will be calling this podcast Target Rich Environment.
Oh, I hope my wife doesn't listen to this.
And to everyone at home, thanks for listening and hope to see you next time. I've been Will Evans, this has been Rock and Roll Farming. Thank you and good night.